This morning I want to talk to you about habits. You can think of habits as a kind of shortcut that our brains take. Neuroscientists tell us that our brains are very, very energy hungry, and they like to take shortcuts wherever they can. For example, one very common kind of shortcut is to just do whatever is familiar. So imagine me on a quick trip to Kroger one night. I'm in the frozen food section, and I'm looking for ice cream. And I'm faced with a daunting bank of options. Ice cream, as far as I can see to the left and to the right. I, however, do not bring all of my brain power to bear on this decision, analyzing ingredients and fat content and carbs and price and so forth. Been there, done that, and my brain, like your brain, is an economizer, so I just grab what I know I like. Easy. Done. Doing something over and over lays down a pathway in our brains, much the way that water lays a path in the ground when it flows downhill and over the course of millions of years forms a riverbed. For us, it's easy, it's really effortless to just allow our thoughts and our actions to follow the path that they always follow. These mental shortcuts or habits govern really hundreds of choices that we make every day. And by itself, each choice that we make may seem kind of inconsequential, but cumulatively and over the span of a lifetime, they really etch the path that we follow in the world. I had the privilege this last June of presiding at the interment of my uncle Leonard Lee, known as Lee Renninger. It was a sunny day. The sky was very blue over that little hillside cemetery in Hooper, Nebraska. My Aunt Jan and my Uncle Tom were there. My mom and my sister were there, some other, maybe half a dozen other relatives. It was a small gathering. And Jan had laid out a table with a lace tablecloth and some flowers and a picture of Lee from when he was a child, taken maybe 70 years earlier. When it came time for me to speak about Lee's life, I didn't worry about the fact that I had spent far less time with him than Aunt Jan or really most of the people who were there. They all live near him, and I did not. I didn't worry about that because even though I hadn't spent as much time, I didn't have as many stories, I felt like I really knew. I knew Lee, and I knew him because I knew quite a bit about his habits. I knew his habit of quiet generosity, his habit of collecting old children's books, his habit of scouting antique stores for interesting pieces of old glassware. I knew his habit of educating himself about everything under the sun, even though he had never been to college. I knew his habit of finding humor in people's eccentricities. I was told of the habits of peaceableness and patience that he exhibited during his last months when he suffered from cancer. So these and other habits, I would say, are what made Lee a consistent and singular human being, much more than his name or his appearance or his social security number. These habits really made him who he was. Well, maybe you've been thinking about your own habits now that a new school year is beginning. Maybe you've resolved to do some things differently. That's great. Neuroscientists tell us that although you can't actually, this is kind of the bad news part, you can't actually wipe away the old neurological pathway, what you can do is develop a new response to a particular cue. And then over time, as you practice it, that new response also etches itself in your brain. So you can think of yourself as kind of a private army corps of engineers directing the water to follow a new course. If you want to lay down new habits, new psychic pathways, you have to scrutinize the patterns that you're following now. If there's an old pattern that you want to change, you first need to pay attention to how it works. You have to become conscious of it. So what is the usual cue And what is your habitual response? That's the question to ask yourself. What external factor or internal nudge cues my brain to go rummaging through the freezer at 10 p.m. in search of ice cream? And to want it so badly that I'll get into the car and drive to Kroger at 10:15, even though it's pouring down rain? What pattern of habitual thought makes me think that that is really the only thing that can satisfy my craving at that particular moment? And why is it so hard to resist that voice coming from my other shoulder, the one saying, you know, it really probably isn't worth it. It might not even be that good for you. Visible habits like what or how much we eat, how much we imbibe, whether we smoke, how much we exercise, how much we study, all of those kinds of very visible habits are hard to change. They are very hard to change. We all know that. Not only neurological factors, but in some cases social and cultural pressures and systemic factors, as Dr. Mumford talked about yesterday, can keep us from making changes that would help us to flourish. Yet the visible habits, I want to suggest, the visible habits are not as hard to change as the habits that we can't see. Maybe you've never thought about your typical response to social and emotional cues as habits, but they are. So how do you respond when you encounter someone with whom you disagree? How do you respond when you encounter someone from an identity group that you don't particularly like? What about when you hear gossip or disparaging remarks? What about when you feel someone has disrespected you or otherwise wronged you? What about when you realize that you yourself have behaved badly? What about when someone asks you for help? Our default responses, and we all have default responses to these kinds of cues, may be the hardest habits to change because we don't even think about them as habits. We don't think about them at all, for the most part. Yet they have extraordinary impact for good or for bad in our own lives individually and within our community. A recent New York Times article entitled "Hello, Stranger" reports on a study by behavioral scientists. They offered $5 Starbucks cards to people who would agree to strike up a conversation with a stranger who sat next to them on the subway. Now, most of the people, when they were first approached about this, were not really excited about it. They were pretty sure that it would be very difficult for them to do, and that the people that they talked to might react with alarm or might just get upset in some way. And yet they did it, and not one single person rebuffed the friendly advance by the people in this experiment. Moreover, the people who initiated the conversation reported that they felt better after doing that than they normally did at the end of a commute on the subway. So the cue: see a stranger on a train. The usual habit: look down at your phone. Don't make eye contact. New habit: make a connection. When we start thinking about our responses to emotional and social cues as habits, I would suggest, then the possibility of genuine transformation and healing open up. I'm talking about transformation of us as individuals. I'm talking about transformation of our community here at Louisville Seminary. I'm talking about healing and transformation of the church. I'm talking about healing and transformation of the world. But in order for that kind of healing and transformation to occur, to realize those possibilities, we have to first become conscious. Only when we actually see our old, familiar, patterned responses can we begin to try to substitute different ones. The seeing is really the hard part. Mostly we don't want to see. We know our old pathways so well that we can walk them blindfolded. And to get off of that path is to take a risk. It's to become vulnerable. We might mess up. We might look foolish. We might fail. Better not to see. Better not to risk. So, brothers and sisters, the bad news is that left to our own devices, not much is going to change. But there's good news. There's good news. The good news is that we are not left to our own devices. We are not left to our own devices. As people of faith, we believe that we have help to see the things that are hard to see, and we have power to change the things that are hard to change. The help that we are given comes from above. Both of our texts for today testify to the divine assistance that is so graciously given to us. Psalm 19 has two parts that are very different, and yet that work together, and it's so conveniently printed out here in your bulletin. So just take a look at your bulletin for a moment, and you'll see that part one, the part that the five voices read, is about the glory of creation. It's about God's marvelous light, God's mysterious word, God's wisdom spread throughout the universe. Then part two, the part that's in bold, is about Torah, the Jewish law. Like the sun and the stars and the firmament, Torah is given by God as a means of enlightenment. Its precepts help people to see. The commandment of God is clear, the psalmist writes, enlightening the eyes and making wise the simple. To be sure, the psalmist acknowledges, entry into the ark of Torah's radiance will expose our hidden faults. Yet immersion in the law also brings joy and refreshment. The law revives the soul. It rejoices the heart. It's more to be desired than fine gold. It's sweeter than the drippings of the honeycomb. Now, I want you to notice there, what I see there, hints about the time that must be spent with Torah, as with a companion or a mentor, in order to reap these kinds of changes. The simple don't become wise instantaneously. Wisdom is acquired gradually. Torah is a gift that enlightens with power to shape grace-filled habits of the heart, but it's not a quick fix. Such shaping takes time and devotion, submission, one might say, to the wisdom of the universe and the wisdom of the Word. According to our second text from the Epistle of James, our habits reveal whether or not we have availed ourselves of the divine resources at our disposal. Have we availed ourselves of the divine power that is at our disposal? Who is wise and understanding among you? Show by your good life that your works are done with gentleness born of wisdom. But if you have envy and bitter selfish ambition in your hearts, do not be boastful or false to the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, devilish. For where there is envy and selfish ambition, there will also be disorder and wickedness of every kind. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without a trace of partiality or hypocrisy, and a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace for those who make peace. Now, James, more than any other writer in the New Testament, insists that our faith must show itself. Be ye doers of the word and not hearers only. It must show itself, not in empty expressions of piety, but in love and justice toward the poor and the weak and the disenfranchised, the outcast. This focus on kindness and justice made the Epistle of James a favorite book of the slave-turned-abolitionist Frederick Douglass. Douglass gave one speech in particular, quoting James, after Douglass had been accused of undermining religion by condemning Southern preachers for supporting slavery. Let me say that again. They said he undermined religion because he condemned Southern preachers who supported slavery. In his response, Douglas quotes the passage from James. I won't read it again, but he quotes the passage from James about the wisdom from above. And then he says this, "I love the religion that sends its people to bind up the wounds of him that has fallen among thieves. I love that religion that makes it the duty of disciples to visit the fatherless and the widow in their affliction. I love that religion that is based upon the glorious principle of love to God and love to humankind, which makes its followers do unto others as they themselves would be done by." But then he continues that it's out of his love for such true religion that he hated, and I'm quoting, "the slave holding, the woman whipping, the mind darkening, the soul destroying religion that exists in the southern states of America. Loving the one, I must reject the other. Holding to the one, I must hate the other. And I, therefore, proclaim myself an infidel to the slave holding religion of America." In this speech, James is not only quoting James 3, he's also referring to the teachings of Jesus. Jesus' parable of the Good Samaritan, for example. Jesus' teaching in the Sermon on the Mount that you cannot serve two masters, two religions. You see, Douglas saw the teaching of James and the teaching of Jesus as deeply compatible with one another. We must, he thought, try to conform our religion to Jesus' instruction, even if it costs us dearly. Douglas was one who achieved great fame, and yet, as a consequence of his activism, he was pursued by the law for much of his life. There is risk, brothers and sisters, there is risk in immersing ourselves in the wisdom that comes from above. But there is also the possibility of true freedom. Indeed, James, who is, I think, sometimes wrongly accused of upholding the law at the expense of grace, refers twice to the law of liberty, the wisdom that Jesus learned from Torah and taught, the wisdom incarnate in Jesus himself, brings not burden or bondage, but liberty. When we open ourselves to the wisdom from above, we are liberated from our own destructive patterns of thought and action. We see how our patterns are destructive to ourselves and to others. We become conscious beings. And we are liberated to work on behalf of others who are held captive by bonds of prejudice and systems of injustice. Like Douglas, we are free to choose which God, which religion we will serve. Free to give gifts to others the way that we are given gifts from above. Free to establish new patterns of living and giving in response to old cues. So now is, I think, it's a great time to be thinking about your patterns for the year. In fact, I would say it's a great time to be thinking about your patterns for your life. Are you making full use of the light that comes from above? I'm talking about the marvelous light of God's word and God's wisdom spread throughout the universe, proclaimed by the sun and the stars in the firmament, located, found in these scriptures given to us, incarnate in the person of Jesus Christ. This is the light that makes the simple wise. This is the light that makes us conscious, truly conscious beings, able to radiate the love of Christ outward to other people. This is the light that sets us free. Thanks be to God. Amen.